Thank you so much. Yeah, with Nicholas Rurik in Mongolia, for those of you who do not know, his wife was one of the great theosophists, the early theosophists, but he was one of the great painters of the last century, perhaps in many people's minds the greatest painter of the first half of the 20th century. But he lived in Mongolia for a couple of years and traveled through the seven Mongolias for 6 or 7 years. And many of his greatest paintings were either created there or inspired by those visits. And in particular, his fascination with Shambhala. But as well as being a great mystic and writer, he also wanted to, he was a kind of a political intriguer. And he hoped very much to combine Tibet, Mongolia, Buryat, Tuva, Inner Mongolia, Hohenor, and Manchu, or Manchukuo, those seven great Buddhist countries, and make one super country to kind of usher in the 1,000 years of the Golden Age. Like most great ideas, it didn't work, but anyway, it was a good idea. And not at all impossible at that time. The League of Nations had just formed, and nobody really knew what was or what wasn't a country outside of Europe. Europe was the only country that really had clear borders or had a strong sense of independence. And in Asia, Africa, much of South America, the boundaries were much more, and the relationships were much more. Anyway, he was a great genius, which is the reason why I took it upon myself to try to save the house he had lived in there and turn it into a Shambhala Art Institute. I thought tonight what I'd do is I have some slides to show with the sort of basic tantric images, and we can look at those later, but I thought I'd talk a little bit first about tantric meditation and what it is. Most of you have some knowledge of it, of course. But because I'm a fully enlightened being, and I'm Irish and very modest, so I wouldn't brag. I wouldn't say that bragging. I thought it would be perhaps useful just to talk a little bit about Tantra before we start the images and the slideshow. I think in the West, many people think of Tantra as predominantly connected with sexuality. And it is connected in the sense that Tantra is a path to enlightenment that uses every facet of human experience or human life as a opportunity for enlightenment or as a force for enlightenment. And of course, for ordinary humans, if there's no sexuality, then there's no humans. We disappear after a generation or two. So it means certainly some people will think that it's worth continuing the human race, and therefore sexual encounters will be part of life, or the sexual experience will be part of life. And in ordinary, many of the ordinary, or what we call a rakpa in Tibetan, the name is rakpa, which means using the ordinary level of consciousness, sexuality is often avoided in the idea that it easily becomes kind of a sensory indulgence and something like an addiction. Also, as with all the objects of the senses, seeing things, listening, smelling, tasting, touching, when we do meditation, sensory activity can be the opposite, pulls the mind or the awareness away from inner-centeredness toward outer spherosity. Is that a new word in the English language? Can I copyright that? And henceforth, if anyone uses spherosity, will I get like a penny? But in many of the meditative traditions around the world, sexuality was regarded as something kind of opposite to spirituality. And so very often, people pursuing a spiritual life would feel it necessary to go pretty well in the opposite direction. So because of that, Tantra, because it included sexuality, it sort of got a reputation for that side of its history. And also, I think, because when it came west, it came in the Victorian times, when sexuality was a kind of a very taboo subject, then the fact that sexuality was addressed in a positive way in Tantra became something of a hot topic. And of course, the minute the Californians found out about it, the whole idea went in a whole other direction, and it became a complete path to enlightenment in and of itself. But in the Asian Tantra, and Tantra is practiced traditionally, Buddhist Tantra is practiced in tradition, in the tradition, the sexual aspect was something that was incorporated in the path in a kind of a normal way. So, for instance, if we look at Buddhist Sutra path, the outer Buddhism, we say Theravada and Mahayana, when they talk about sexuality, all they talk about is kind of the don'ts with sexuality, like not by force and not more than, I don't know, five times a day, not like anyone underage, those kind of rules. There's never a discussion of the positive side. But because in Tantra there is that discussion of the positive side, then of course the Californians got very excited about that and made a lot of picture posture books concerning it. But in reality, for most Asian practitioners over the centuries, the sexual aspect has been just a very minor part of it. And more large is, say, the eating yoga, how you eat properly in terms of, and that doesn't mean a diet, a particular kind of diet necessarily, but the kind of awareness you use and the kind of meditation or visualization at the time of eating. Or going to sleep. And, you know, Tibetans tend to be a little on the lazy side. So for Tibetans, they love the sleep yogas and the dream yogas because, you know, sitting up in meditation and like this, you can get sore knees and sore back and sore bottom and many sore spots. But sleeping and dreaming yoga is extremely pleasant. You basically just stretch out and you sleep and you dream. But as with eating or as with sexuality, you do it with a particular kind of mental application or spiritual application or yogic application. And of course, here in the TS, I've taught dream yoga, I think, three or four times over the years. So I'm sure all of you now can sleep standing on your heads, dreaming with utter clarity. The Buddhist tradition states that, you know, we're like about 1% through this sort of sphere of human experience, what's called the Kalpa Bhadra, or the lucky age, the age when there's lots of Irish people on the planet. No, the Kalpa Bhadra, the auspicious age. We're about a 1% or half of 1% through that 100,000, some hundreds of thousands of year cycle. And said that we'll have 1,000 great masters or Buddhas whose teachings will become universal. And we're only up to the fourth one yet. And we're only halfway through that fourth one. So I guess that makes us, what, 1/4 of 1% through our lucky Irish age. And that the speciality of each one of those 1,000 Buddhas is a little different, how they teach, what they teach, because it fits with the time and the place and kind of the mental characteristics or dispositions or culture or whatever, what have you, of that period. And the previous Buddha, Shakyamuni, of the 1,000, it said that he is the only one of this 1,000 who emphasizes Tantra. And all of the others also teach like ordinary sutra or the ordinary Buddhist way or the ordinary enlightenment path. But the extraordinary Tantra, it said, is only taught by this Shakyamuni Buddha. What are the other extraordinary things of the other, like 997 Buddhas? We really don't know exactly. But for that reason, it said the Tantra is something very special or very exceptional, because for this whole, I don't know, half million year period, only this 5,000 year period of human history has it. I suppose the others will have things like flying or levitating or meditating in under the water, something like that. But it's only this 5,000 year period where any of the 1,000 enlightened beings of this eon teach the tantras. Now, it's also said that only in the tantric path do you achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, that the other ordinary kind of enlightenment methodology using coarse consciousness or rough levels of consciousness or ordinary levels of consciousness, it takes a minimum of 16 lifetimes, and in most people much more. Like Irish get it in 16 lifetimes and Scottish in 1600 lifetimes and Russians in 16,000 lifetimes. Are there any Scots or Russians here? If so, I hope you like planet Earth. I shouldn't laugh at my own jokes. So. I just brought a small group of theosophical people to Mongolia this summer. It's kind of a very limited invitation-only group by someone out on the West Coast, but they had only one rule. I had to tell one joke every hour for the whole trip. And so I'm sort of on a roll. So I thought I'd just read a little bit from what the 13th Dalai Lama has to say, which is a previous. And he was a very wonderful Dalai Lama. He and the fifth are the only two for whom the name Chenpo is used. The great. They don't say the great first, the great second, the great third, the great fourth. Only the great fifth and the great 13th. And even though the others were great in their own ways, those were the two who most openly taught Tantra. And because Tantra incorporates every aspect of life, then it's also said that for that reason, they were the two greatest kings of the Dalai Lamas who had served as kings. The others tending to be more of the monk consciousness and therefore somewhat, you could say, hands-off in terms of ordinary worldly affairs. The others tended to spend more time in the monasteries or in meditation caves and living monkly style lives, doing monkly kind of things. Whereas these two Dalai Lamas, although they both did their three-year retreats, in fact, they both did them twice, after their enlightenment, actually fought with the monasteries more than lived in monasteries. I think one problem in Tibet was monasteries tended to become a little bit, set in their ways of doing things, and not that open to new ideas and to, at least in their periods. Anyway, the Dalai Lamas took them on, and those two Dalai Lamas. And for that reason, neither of them get mentioned in many Buddhist lineages in transmission, Because in Tibet, to be mentioned in the line of transmission, you have to be both you have to both have achieved enlightenment in that lifetime and have been popular with everyone. Mm-hmm. But because those two Dalai Lamas were both unpopular with the monks, they don't get mentioned in that many official lineages of transmission. But both are the only two to get the title great, because not only did they achieve enlightenment, but they managed to bring greatness into the whole of Tibet. I said the fifth because he's the one who united the country and made Tibet what we think of it today. It was his work and his genius which sort of forged the nation. He was, if you will, the kind of what King Arthur did in England in legend, he did in Tibet in reality. And the great 13th went through both first the British invasion of Tibet, an attempt to take it over, and then the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1909 and to take it over. And then the Russians were also intriguing, but never actually got the courage to invade and try and take it over. But he managed to bring the country through those periods and do so with leaving it stronger than when he actually came. So the invasions actually, in some sense, made it a stronger country. But it says there are two Mahayana vehicles for traveling to complete Buddhahood, the Prajnaparamita and profound Vajrayana. Of these, the latter greatly surpasses the former. This is as well known as the sun and the moon. How well are the sun and the moon known? Are they as well known as the stars? There are many people who know this fact and pretend to carry the tradition of the sages, yet who don't search for the nature of the profound Vajrayana. If they are wise, who is foolish? To meet with this rare and perilous legacy, and yet still to ignore it, how absolutely astounding. So in other words, he's saying that the Tantrayana is the great quintessential teaching of the Buddha, the fast path to enlightenment. And in Tibet in his time, many people knew this, yet they still didn't take up the practice. So if they are wise, who is foolish? So in this way, he kind of puts it very clearly that he takes Vajrayana himself as the main way of practicing, the main way of approaching enlightenment. In his work, he goes on to say that there's four things that make Tantra especially great. There's four reasons why Tantra bring enlightenment in one lifetime, and the other ways of practicing without Tantra are more slow. But of those four, the main one is the mental attitude toward the self, who and what we think we are. Often in Buddhism, we use the expression anatma, or non-self, that there is no self. And that's because, by that Buddhism, I don't think Buddha is actually saying there isn't a self, but rather that the sense of self we have is so completely different than our actual nature of ourself. That if I think, who am I? And the image I get, that image is so completely different. Or I should put that another way. If an unenlightened being thinks of who am I, that image of self that arises is so completely different from the actual nature of being that it has no basis whatsoever in reality. In other words, nobody has a clue about who and what they are until they achieve a deep level of meditative experience. Sometimes it's said that when you get it the first time in meditation, when you get a direct experience of the nature of self, then you become what's known as an Arya, a saint. Like St. Glenn. I was growing up in Quebec. I was so angry. I'm really jealous of the French, you know. It's like when you travel around Quebec, is Saint-Andimont, Saint-Jean-Pierre, Saint-Louis. It's like endless. Every town is named after a saint. And you go through the English towns, and it's named like Fox River, Three Rivers, Two Sisters. I always thought it would be really nice if they named one town in Quebec where I was born, St. Glen. I have to put together a lobby force, don't I? Secretly. You guys can all start writing to the Premier of Quebec. We would like to come and visit Quebec. We're always looking for a town there called St. Glen. We can't come until a town has that name. I do feel like a saint. I feel saintly today. Anyway, the Buddhist definition of a saint is someone who actually knows who they are, knows the nature of the self, knows, sees that the ordinary sense of self that is generated through the skandhas, through the mental and physical and emotional aggregates, a kind of a conceptual image, a conceptual emotional image, you could say, construct that arises from our childhood and then our education and people we meet and the things we do. That sense of self, when we understand how it works and we can work with it effectively, yet we see that it's just kind of like a bubble floating around in the fishbowl of our continuum of experience. It's not really who and what we are. It's said that when we directly, non-conceptually get that experience, we become an Arya, a saint. And so until that time, we're always operating on a distorted sense of self, a sense of self that is completely out of sync with the nature of reality. And so because our sense of self is out of sync with actual reality, we have one of two ways to go about remedying that problem. One is to study who I am and what I am, and try to refine our sense of self. Does that sound like a sensible thing to do? Say yes or no answer. Yes. Nope. Wrong answer. Again. And the reason why it's a hopeless approach, completely 100% hopeless approach, is that the person who thinks he is or she is asking the question is asking from that distorted mental state. In other words, the person saying, who am I, has a sense of I asking that question, who am I? So it's a distorted self asking a sphere of the sphericity of experience, looking within the framework of one's own stream of experience, which is distorted by that very sense of self. So it said, the doer, the doing, and the done too, those three factors, are all distorted in the non-saint, in the person who does not have direct experience of the way things are. So for that reason, simply asking, who am I, and trying to study self and so on and so forth, can both be very slow and very cumbersome, and in fact, can almost be like a dog chasing its own tail and being very puzzled why it is never able to catch that tail. Unless it's, of course, got a very short body when it can't catch it. But gets very little benefit from it. So the idea, well, the basis of tantric practice is that because we don't have a clue who and what we are, and moreover, because the sense of self that we generate by the time we're 7 or 8 years old, 10 years old, becomes very crystalline and very hard, and particularly by the time we're 21 or 22, once we cross those years, we have a distinct sense that we know who we are and what we are. And after that, the ego image is pretty well set in stone. And only very radical experiences, things like near-death experiences or very great disasters, or for some very few, some karmically released epiphanies can come and create a transformation. But that's like one, that's like almost like winning the lottery to make that great breakthrough to the nature of self, to an understanding of nature of self. You see, David, you were wrong. You got it. You were wrong. See, when you said yes, sounds good. But it was trick. Well, it was a trick question. When you ask the question, you have to make it sound very sensible, you see. It's like, would you like to bet on this? It's a sure thing. That sort of tone I put in my voice, like, it's a sure thing. You should have been suspicious right at that moment. When an Irishman, like, relaxes his voice and starts using a very soft, persuasive tone, you know you're being set up. So the idea is that because it is so difficult for an adult with a fixed sense of self to go beyond the conditioned self, the sense of self created by those first 20 or 25 years of experience, that it's best just to drop the issue altogether, just drop the sense, drop the quest, drop the investigation altogether, and not bother with it, and simply create a kind of a yogic sense of self, to drop the ordinary sense of self 100%, and to follow a yogic path in which the sense of self is projected according to particular principles. And those three basic principles are always used. First is the body. I saw a very comical cartoon a few months ago, and it's like this extremely beautiful woman looking in a mirror, and the reflection she sees back is like not at all beautiful. Like she's just looking in the mirror, there's this extremely wonderful, magnificent, beautiful lady looking in the mirror, and all she sees back is someone who's like a little too big here, or nose is too big or too small, or ears are too in or too out, and hips are too high or too low. And then there's a guy looking in the mirror who's like completely out of shape and ugly and has every fault that can possibly be attributed to a male human being of his age level. And he looks in the mirror and he kind of sees a Superman. But it's a little bit like that, isn't it? Women are such incredibly beautiful things, like perfect in every way. And they look in the mirror and they only see imperfections in themselves. And men have so many imperfections. One might say they're like almost completely, they're like the bumblebee, that it's almost impossible to imagine how they fly. It's like a... It's something of a scientific mystery, isn't it? But yet, a beautiful woman looks in the mirror and only sees imperfections. And a guy looks in a mirror completely imperfect and sees only this perfect godlike being. So in Tantra, the idea is there that our sense of the body, just like the sense of self, of soul, or sense of self, of emotions, or sense of self, of who and what we are in life, and our sense of bodiness, embodiment, is always distorted. Distorted by our own expectations, distorted by cultural conditionings. When the self is like that, we are basically uncomfortable in our own bodies. You know, people grumbling about poor old Obama giving $1 trillion to his banker friends. You know, we spend that much on gym equipment in a couple of years. Just to die prematurely of heart attacks. So the first thing Tantra tries to do with sense of self is redefine it or give a different sense of it. To give that ability to people to just relax and feel comfortable in their own bodies. And for that, generally, depending on what tantra, what initiation you take, you see yourself as looking in being like that tantric deity. But no flesh, no blood, no bone. Your body just a kind of a magical holographic image of pure radiance and pure energy. So with every movement you make, it's just the flow of pure energy and pure radiance. Because we don't really know what our body is like anyway, do we? I mean, I look in the mirror and I see this magnificent superhuman. And I know that not everyone sees me like that. I mean, most people do, but only those at very, very high merit. I think the other thing with the tantric approach is this kind of idea that with our body, with our emotions, with our mind, with our sense of our role in life, to bring in a kind of a discipline of intense kind of positive enthusiasm. It's sort of like life is what it is at any given moment. So whatever it is at that given moment, try to make it as comfortable and as joyful and as happy as you can possibly make it. When you are comfortable, you are joyful, and you are happy, then that kind of makes a joyful, happy environment. And so even if things are a little uncomfortable in some ways, you will still feel quite joyful, quite happy. And I think in life, we can only control maybe, you know, the little tip of the iceberg of this great universe that surrounds us. The rest of it really is just something we have to harmonize with, flow with, have a sense of integration with. So the tantric approach is with the body. Give it this sense of being pure radiance, pure light, joyful, pleasurable. and give it a nice look. So sometimes the tantric deities are a little ugly, but ugly can be nice also. Make it a nice ugly. Like some of the tantric deities are very beautiful and very peaceful, and others look very ferocious and very wild. Ferocious and wild can also be joyful and delightful in its own way, if it is a flowing, harmonious ferocity. So with the body, always to have that sense with one's own body, and with other living beings, to have the sense, same sense of them, that they are almost dreamlike in presence, or ethereal in presence. To try to see the radiance or the joyful presence of other beings. Physically. As though they were like little rainbows, figures, stick figures wrapped in rainbows, something like that. The seventh Dalai Lama says, one's own body seen as the body of a deity. And deity here just means deity of light. All others seen as dakas and dakinis. Dakas and dakinis literally mean flyers or levitators. Kadro is the Tibetan word, beings who can fly. Their bodies are so light and ephemeral that they can just take off and levitate or fly. And then with one's own emotions, to always to keep the mind relaxed, radiant, and joyful. Sometimes the seventh Dalai Lama uses the word playful, rolpa. Relaxed and playful, joyful, playful. And then with mind, to leave mind completely uncontrived, unformulated. So when we say only a saint knows self, lesser beings only know false self. The Tantra takes the idea that this is how a saint naturally sees things. A saint sees the real nature of the body and sees pure energy, sees the nature of emotion and feels always joy, sees the nature of self and feels the vastness of infinity. Something like that. And because that's what they feel, see, think, experience, they rest in the sphere of Aryahood or saintly existence. What Tantra does is it says, because we don't know what we are like until we're saints, we should take what it is like for a saint and make it how we are. We should just simply borrow this sort of mischievous, playful sainthood from the saints and bring it into our own life. So of the four points that make Tantra special, that's the first. The second is energy control. And those of you who come on the weekends, we'll look at a little bit about what that means, how to always keep the energies or the subtle energies of the body in such a place and such a sphere that the daily living, emulating the style of a natural-born saint, that this becomes easily accomplished. Simply because if you keep the energies of the body in perfect harmony, it encourages a kind of an ability to emulate saintliness. And the other point being the Mahamudra, the ability to balance, or the ability to bring infinity and the finite world together in each moment's experience. So it's said that Buddha taught many thousands of tantras, but tonight we'll look at some slides of some basic ones and just talk about how some of this saintly behavior plays in those particular tantra practices. And for that, I'll move over to the podium. And, you know, saints always like to stand at podiums. I will playfully walk to this playful podium. Now, I'm not sure how exactly this works, but we'll... Basically, what I did is the 13th Dalai Lama points out that there's four basic levels of tantra. Each of those has its own kind of character. But of all the four, they all begin with something called mandala meditation. When we see it painted, it looks flat like this, but actually it should be laying flat and three-dimensional, and it goes up to the top of the universe and down to the bottom of the universe. And in this vast sphere, there's just this kind of little flying saucer with those kind of like being little pop-up figures. Like if you laid that flat on the ground, the figures would pop up like cardboard figures do in a child's cardboard box. This image in particular is of the Tara Tantra, the female Buddha Tara. Normally we say, if you're going to practice the path, the tantric path of emulating an Arya, or emanating an enlightened being, then there's five things which are always kept in the sphere of enlightenment. Body as enlightened energy, sort of emotions as enlightened joy, mind as enlightened non-conceptuality, kusanto yunden, your personal charisma, well-pruned and prissy. And finally, trinle, your activity, everything you do in the world, sort of running in high gear at all times, full, flat, open, that accomplishing countless auspicious deeds in the world effortlessly. And Tara is the one who symbolizes that. And she's painted green because green is the color of the primordial energy. So I thought I'd put that one up to start. And at the top, we've got the Buddha sitting there as a monk, and beside him sitting many non-monks. Because in India, the tantras were always practiced by lay people. And then later in Tibet, they became stolen from us by the monks. But we plan to steal them back. And this is another similar mantra, mandala. So every tantric system, and it's said that each of the four levels of tantra has many hundreds of different tantric systems, but not all of them are taught in any generation, that some are more useful in some generations and others in other generations, and that these are kept on a kind of an etheric level by particular kinds of lineage holders, or rigzin as they're known in Tibetan, knowledge holders. And as the generations pass, those tantric systems which are useful for those centuries or those millenniums are taught. This one in particular is Amitayas, who is the healing Buddha. So this practice is done by people who hate doctors and who look at doctors as the scourge of the earth, as torturers. What is that great Cole Porter song? If they are a doctor, they will face you with dread. If you are a dentist, they will wish you are dead. Be a clown. Anyway, a lot of tantricas usually try to do meditation and mantra for their healing and to stay away from people with knives and hammers. This is a kind of a painting called Sogshing in Tibetan. If we look over it, it's actually got kind of the lineups of what are all the main tantric systems in the Tibetan world. And each one of those starting with highest class of tantras and then coming down to Kriyacharya yoga tantras and so forth. Oh, there are the Kriyacharya tantras and here are some of the yoga tantras. So coming down in the various levels of tantras. And so it sort of represents those main tantric systems that are practiced at least within the new schools, the Kagyu, Sakya, Relug, Shiche, Chonang, and Gelugpa. The Nyingma are a little different because their tantras came from west of Tibet, whereas the new tantras mostly came from south of Tibet. Sometimes they'll put Buddha at the center. Sometimes in the Gelugpa, we'll put Tsongkhapa at the center. And if Tsongkhapa is at the center, either Buddha will be at his heart. Tsongkhapa, of course, is the founder of the Yellow School, the guru of the first Dalai Lama. And for Theosophists, she was kind of one of the great inspirations of Madame Blavatsky. By the way, have you all seen the video that Steve made of the Blavatsky trip to Tibet? I saw it today for the first time. Very nicely done. I thought I'd start with just a couple of, when we talk about lower tantras and how does tantra go for enlightenment, when we say tantra, they talk about Rigsum Gampo, the three natures. To become a fully enlightened being, we need three qualities, compassion, wisdom, power. So if we go here, this becomes Buddha of compassion, Buddha of wisdom, Buddha of power. And I think in early times in India, people would often practice just these three basic tantras. Oh, rather than my...
The thing right in the middle there.
Right. Yeah. Aha. Ha-ha-ha. I can give lessons in writing Tibetan letters. Om. Om. But anyway, I think in ancient India, often people would start with one, with say the Buddhist form representing compassion. And rather than sit and meditate on compassion in kind of a conceptual way, as is done in Tantra, just to simply become or visualize oneself as being compassion embodied. And do the mantra of compassion, and while doing it, to combine that with the meditation on the nature of self or the nature of the sense of I of the body, I of emotions, and I of spirit or soul. They would then go down to wisdom, which is directly the way of looking directly at who and what we are and the nature of self. But again, rather than doing it as a conceptual investigation, doing it in this kind of tantric way of visualized application. And finally, the third being over on the bottom right, the Buddha of power, Vajrapani. And now, Asians have this thing of always thinking of themselves as incarnations and thinking of the world as being incarnations. And also thinking of particular countries as being connected more to one Buddha form than the other. So in the old days, Tibet was compassion. Therefore, the Dalai Lama was and is the Buddha of compassion. Mongolia was power with Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan, the great warriors. And therefore, Genghis Khan is an incarnation of Vajrapani, as was Kublai Khan. Now, the fact that he bumped off a few people in trying to bring create a peaceful world is not considered a bad thing. It's like they really were just people who he had deep connection with from previous lives that he was kind of helping them get out and beyond the limitations of this lifetime more quickly. And they would in a future life take a higher incarnation. So Vajrapani is always shown wearing this tiger skin, a symbol of power and of energy. Also the tiger, of course, is a predator. It kills. But the meaning here is that kind of force, the forceful application of wisdom, compassion and wisdom. When we put the three together, then we say the body is compassion, emotions are wisdom, emotions and concepts are wisdom, and spirit, pure spirit or mind, becomes power. So rather than do that in kind of the ordinary conceptual way, here in Tantra, it's done through the through a visualization and an energy practice, kind of power breathing exercises, and also then mantra and so forth. This is another way the three, compassion, wisdom, and power, are often shown, with compassion in the center, wisdom, and power. And those of you who traveled to Tibet, this image of thousand-armed, thousand-eyed, thousand hands, 11 heads, 1,000 arms, and 1,000 eyes. Sort of compassion as this ability to see things that need doing in the world, and seeing them in a compassionate, sympathetic way. But not just seeing, but then actually doing them, hence the arms. Often, that kind of practice is considered Kriya Acharya, which means lower Tantra. It's often called Ogyu, because there's not a lot of energy or chakra nadi practice done with it. There's not a lot of internal energy practice done with it. So no Kundalini Yoga. But in Yoga Tantra and the fourth Maha Anuttara Yoga, they combine both ordinary and also and combine what they do in Kriya and Charya, they combine that with the five chakra practice. So here you have five different Buddhas, Amitabha and so forth, or the five Buddha families, each representing one of those. Shenrezig, of course, is not only used in Kriya Tantra, Charya Tantra, and Yoga Tantra, but in highest Yoga Tantra becomes Gyawa Gyatso. So then compassion becomes the fullness of the experience. Should be pointed out, usually in Kriya and Charya Tantra, there's a lot of dietary restrictions, things you can and cannot eat. Yoga Tantra has less restriction, and highest Yoga Tantra, generally no restriction. In particular, in the Kriya Charya, they're very down on onions and garlic. So I did Kriya Tantra for about a week. And I gave myself a graduate certificate because I love Italian cooking. And no garlic, no Italian cooking. And Dalai Lama has given this Gyawa Gyatso initiation. This is a lineage comes very strongly from the seventh Dalai Lama. Then before we saw the three bodhisattvas with Shenrezig at the center. It's said that everyone has one of three natures in Kriya Charya practice. You're either the compassion nature, the wisdom nature, or the power nature. So compassion, a kind of a softer kind of person. Wisdom nature, more kind of intellectual, intense nature. And power, a kind of a real go-getter, super active in the world kind of person. So usually, if you do the three together, the Lama will do a divination and tell you what is your primordial nature. That becomes your main practice. This is a Sakyapa lineage Tanka, because that's the Lama at the top having those Sakyapa hats. I wish I could get one of those. I like those hats. Manjushri are sometimes not only done for ordinary wisdom practice, but for extraordinary wisdom practice. And each of the different Shenrizi and Manjushri and Vajrapani, there's at least a dozen different forms of each of those, each specializing in something. So this particular form of Manjushri, the white Manjushri, is used for memory. And said when the second Dalai Lama was 16 years old, he did a 3-month retreat on white Manjushri. And before that, he could only memorize half a page of text a day. But after the retreat, he could memorize 17 folios, which is 34 pages a day. Also, he remembered some hundreds of his past lifetimes through that 3-month retreat. So this is kind of a memory practice. I will admit, I myself used to have quite a bad memory, and I did the retreat. And even though my memory didn't become quite as good as his, I did feel quite a dramatic transformation in things I could remember. And of course, that eventually drove me to booze, because there's so much in a man's life he doesn't want to remember. Then when we look at Vajrapani, he's always shown in this ferocious way with his hair flaming up, the color of flames, wrapped in fire and so forth, holding the five-point Vajra, because the five-point Vajra represents the ability to perform all activities in the world and be completely unhindered or unharmed by any of them. You know, ordinary beings, if you do a lot, then when you see attractive things, you get attached, and negative things, you get fearful or afraid or angry and so on. But if we go on the basis of compassion and wisdom, then everything we do in the world becomes completely diamond hard and indestructible. And here is shown at the center with the other two natures below. For those ferocious warrior types, like David, this is the path. Then I wanted to show the same thing with Tara, because it's basically all tantras in the Kriyacharya path are always put in that threefold way. So here, if it's female rather than male, we have Tara in the center as the compassion. Marichi, the yellow on the bottom left, is always shown. Marichi, often called the goddess of sunrise. And Ekajati on the bottom left, Tara's left, our right as we face her. And often thought of as the goddess of nighttime. So in this way, Tara is all activities. Marichi is the rising sun and kind of the transformative power of that. And the wisdom quality of always like the rising sun, that kind of awareness. It said, in life, humans have 8 great obstacles, outer, inner, and secret. So when Tara is shown in this way, she's shown as a kind of a liberator from the 8 great failings. I'm not sure if we can see. I don't like to take this out of full screen and blow it up, but if I could, we'd see all kinds of things like this. There's the lions of pride and the snakes of anger and the thieves of hesitation. So the first Dalai Lama wrote a wonderful poem on those 8, sort of linking. But when one does Tara of the, which frees from the 8 terrors, usually one reads that, I become freed from the lion of pride, I become freed from the snakes of anger, I become freed from the, what is it? I'm sure you guys remember all of the 8. See, I did that white Manjushri retreat, I remembered them all. And sometimes done as 21 Taras, when it's just simply Tara. And the 21, 4 being white, 4 yellow, 4 red, 4 blue, black, or dark green, and 1 in the center, just green, to symbolize all. And for the symbolizes the 4 enlightenment activities in the world. When we practice Tantra well, then everything we do is in the white form is peaceful, Everything we do in yellow form brings increase and abundance and prosperity for self and others. Power is subduing any negativity and being fearless in all situations. And finally, blue or blue-black is wrath or destruction. I wanted to show the white Tara here with the fifth Dalai Lama at top. It's one of the few lineages he's actually shown in because his sadhana or his daily meditation on it became so popular. But he combined the sadhanas written by the first and second Dalai Lamas and made them into a longer fifth Dalai Lama sadhana. But again, Chila Kamitayas is used for healing. And often done as part of a 14-day retreat or a 21-day retreat, where one essentially does a kind of an auric purification. And it's said that even if your head is cut off, if you've done that retreat and you walk out of the retreat and someone cuts your head off, you can just say a mantra, pick it up and put it back on and you'll be okay. I tried to test that once, but I couldn't get anyone to actually cut it off. I guess I'm so thick-headed. And Amitayas here as the healing Buddha, we had the mandala of him before. The healing for Amitayas, mostly a kind of color therapy on the general stage, where the energy, we radiate lights into the body in particular ways to do a kind of laser healing, but using the mind to direct particular colored lights. And then the medicine Buddhas, there's eight medicine Buddhas, and they're done in connection with actual herbal substances. If we look at like Amitayas, there's no actual medicines involved. The only medicine involved is fasting. And usually that fasting is with just water and a stone. And you blow into the stone and you put it in water and you drink the water. And you do that for a couple of months, something like that, and with no food. And that's considered to be, that will heal just about anything. It's kind of a kill you or cure you kind of approach. The medicine Buddhas is where you do use meditation, but in conjunction with traditional medicines. Traditional Tibetan medicines combine herbs, animal products, mineral products, certain kind of acupuncture, although they don't use the small silver needles of the Chinese tradition. They use these enormous gold bulky things that hurt like hell. And this combines it with moxibustion, a kind of heating. They put like a bunch of incense on the end of the golden needle. This very thick, big golden needle looks like, I don't know, something you'd sew a boot with. And then it gets it very hot and it burns that spot where they put it. But apparently it's good for you. I've never tried it. I have watched people do it. I have this kind of sadistic side. Then we skip up to highest yoga tantra with a sexual imagery. So usually in these lower tantras, there's no sexual imagery. And there's a lot of a lot more constricted kind of environment for practice. So it's not like a 24-hour a day practice. It's more of a constricted practice. In the highest yoga tantras, it's much more all embracing every aspect of life. This particular tantra is called Chakrasamvara, the Wheel of Bliss. It's so called because if you can do it properly, then every experience, good, what seemingly good, seemingly bad, seemingly indifferent, are drawn into the field of bliss. So whatever arises is transformed into a blissful experience. This particular transmission is from the lineage known as Shengpa Kargyu in Tibetan. And that Shengpa Kargyu is not actually a Kargyu school the way we think of Kargyupas, not coming from Marpa, but a totally separate, diverse lineage and comes down as the six yogas of Niguma rather than the six yogas of Naropa. That's the mandala for it. Then the Guhya Samaja, which again combines all aspects of life in the practice. Very often in highest yoga tantra, the deities are shown male, female in union because it's bringing about the union of the male-female energies and chemistry of one's own body and on a sort of physical level, and on another level, sort of drawing from the powers of one's male and female ancestors, on an inner level, one's male and female previous lives, and so on. And then Yamantaka, the Dorje Jigje, as he's known in Tibetan, Vajrabhairava, often, usually shown naked, often shown solitary, sometimes with consort, but usually naked and with many weapons. Yamantaka literally means destroyer of death. And each of the 34 arms represents a different yogic practice, a different kind of tantric application. 8 feet for the 8 cities or magical powers, ordinary ones and the higher ones, dancing on various gods and humans and animals and so forth to represent power over those spiritual dimensions. And then Kala Chakra, the initiation which has been given by the Dalai Lama so many times around the world in public. And it's the only one which is generally given in open of the highest yoga tantras, openly to large crowds. The others can only be given to people who have a strong karmic connection with them. So the teacher is supposed to throw dice and say whether or not a person can attend. And then on the first day you get various things, various processes of the ceremony called tagun or analysis. You go home and you watch your dreams, and if the dreams are, the dreams will indicate if you're allowed to come back the next day or not, and so on. But Kala Chakra, everyone can come, because Kala Chakra is thought to be the kind of astrological or astronomy world, the world of astronomy. And because everyone is connected to astrology and astronomy, therefore everyone can come. I thought to put this little lady up at the end. She's in one of the earlier tantras, this one, because that tantra is not only in the time of life, but at the time of death. And at the time of death, in the 6 yogas of Niguma, one puts a naked goddess above one's head and sits just above the crown chakra. And as one meditates, when one does a training in one's lifetime, one takes consciousness up and down the body and practices bringing consciousness to the point of leaving the body, but doesn't actually take it outside the body, and takes it up and down until the kind of birth channel is opened, as it's put. And then at the time of death, one follows breathing and follows the death process, and as one stops breathing and death arises, then one allows one's consciousness after the flash of clear light to fly directly out through the crown chakra and into the womb of the goddess, the Lamo Karmo, by means of tantric energy projection. And in this way, one then transfers directly either from this life to a higher world, if that seems to be the right thing to do, or to a rebirth in this world if there's still work that one can continue to do in this world. For that reason, when a high lama dies, we don't say he died, he kicked the bucket, anything like that. We say Gompa Zos, he completed his work in the world. Then if he doesn't come back, if there's no reincarnation, it's because that being has finished duties in this part of the universe and will go on to other realms where other enlightenment work needs doing. And I thought I'd finish with kind of a wildly sexual one, simply because of the kind of history of Tantra and sexuality. This is Ganesh, or Ganapati, as he's known in Tibetan Buddhism. But the use of sort of wild tantric imagery to symbolize the enlightenment process. So the goddesses both having menstruation, which in ordinary religion is often considered something dirty, and women are often in times of menstruation in cultures around the world sent to live by themselves or with other women and it's considered unclean. But in Tantric Buddhism, it's considered a special time for easy enlightenment because the person is going through such chemical changes at the time. Those very strong chemical changes create a very transformative sense of self, and that transformative sense of self allows for the enlightened sense of self to arise. And of course, the black yogini or dakini shows how that is done by taking the male energies. They go into the womb and are reborn and come out as blissful experience. And then, you know, Tantra is very mysterious. Nobody's got a clue what it means. So here we have six Buddhas floating in six cosmic eggs. And that's to symbolize the mysterious nature of Tantric culture. And that's it.
Well, I want to thank you, Glenn, and I wonder if anyone has any questions. This would be the time to ask.
Yes.
Can you expand on the whole concept of Yamantaka as the destroyer of death?
Well, the Tibetan commentary is about 1,200 pages. But if I were to put it in very brief, I would say that it's achieving enlightenment by resting in the three qualities of perfection. And the perfection which is there on the... Because it means the destroyer of death. And death in the sense that we have a concrete sense of who and what we are. If we relax that sense, then that death is conquered. Death in the sense of a sense of static quality of being. And so resting the mind in a sense of the flow, the omnipresent transformative quality of being. And thirdly, the death, which is giving space, giving any space to unhappiness or any... The way one of my lamas put it is showing compassion towards unhappiness as an entity in your own life. That's called wrong compassion. You should never allow yourself to be unhappy for a single moment. And how do we become unhappy? We're sitting there, everything's perfect. I mean, you take a breath, everything feels completely perfect, and then some negative thought arises. And that thought, sort of like a little niggly swine flu worm, attacks the soul, doesn't it? Attacks the spirit. And we let it in, and we give it room, and then it wiggles around and squiggles around. And before we know it, we go from breathing in joy, breathing out joy, feeling wonder, feeling perfection. And suddenly we're overwhelmed by unhappiness. So it's called wrong compassion, showing any compassion towards your own unhappiness, giving any space to your own unhappiness. And so for that reason, Yamantaka is shown with many weapons to destroy unhappiness. And he's shown with a big erect penis, which is the symbol of joy and bliss and great enthusiasm. Like you can't both be unhappy and feel sexy at the same time. I mean, no one can look at someone who's crying or looking very unhappy and think, oh, I'd like to take that person out dancing or make love to that person. You think, oh, the best you can do is like go over and sit down and chit-chat and give them a cup of coffee and maybe a few cheerful words. So the idea in Tantra is that we have to make every moment that discipline, the samaya, of always keeping the mind in its own sphere of perfection. Then the two horns, one represents resting the mind in the clear light nature of being or the radiance of being, and the other horn represents the what's known as the illusory body, the julu, taking all experience as joyful, illusory, playful theater. The other thing with, if you got like 16 feet, if you hurt one of your legs, you still got 15 left. 16 feet for the 16 aspects of emptiness or ultimate reality. So each one reflects the support of one of the 16 wisdoms, as they're called, 16 wisdoms of emptiness.